Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
They are down to the final few events at the 2011 World Series of Poker, with the main event starting on Thursday. We'll have a preview of that and a recap of what else has been going on. Also, some main event advice from Tony Dunst, the guy who does the Raw Deal show, the Raw Deal segment on the WPT telecast, and one of the reasons why their ratings are up some 35% this season. Also, Dwight Pilgrim, a guy who has had a remarkable run over the last couple of years in circuit events and WPT events, who said earlier this year he was going to shock the world, and in fact did in one WPT event that he took down. You'll hear those a little bit later on in the show. Also, a guy final-tabled the ladies event, and Full Tilt Poker is in trouble again, or even deeper trouble, I should say. Hi, I'm Paul Harrah, sitting at the feature table of the poker room of Harrah's St. Louis, where the Bad Beat jackpot is up to $238,000. And, of course, they're playing cash games and tournaments all around me right now, while my partner, Dennis Phillips, is out in Las Vegas, anxiously waiting to head to the Rio to play in yet another tournament today. Hi, Dennis. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine, Paul. There's definitely, if you're a poker player, Vegas is the place to be during the month of June. There's no doubt about that.
And as we've leaked into the first few days of July, there isn't much left to the World Series of Poker. Today they've got day four of the $50,000 Poker Players Championship, the one with the Chip Reese Trophy. They are up to day three of the 1K event, the biggest 1K event of the year. In fact, the biggest tournament of the year outside of the main event, which drew 4,576 players over this weekend. Today they've got a $1,500 no limit and a 5K PLO8, and then that will be it before the main event starts on Thursday. So before we talk about anything else, I just want to go back to...
This is the required monthly test of the emergency alert system. This station serves the Bi-State St. Louis operational area.
$50K or don't want to expend the $50K then, and I don't know. There were some notable people that weren't in there. There were some people in there that I'd never heard of. So I think we had a little bit of both. Maybe a few people that went deep in a couple of other events turned around and said, well, I'm going to gamble and I'm going to try this $50K. We'll see. The 4,000 plus for the 1K, that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I know 4th of July weekend. I know they were expecting a big turnout. But let's look at the whole series. I have been totally amazed by the whole series. If you actually analyze it, and I haven't got it to the last few events, but through the first two-thirds of it, if you analyze it and look at the 1,000 and the 1,500s, as a whole, they are up tremendously. They're up like 10, 11, 12%. If you look at some of the bigger ones, the 5 and the 10Ks, some of them are actually down overall. So I think what you're seeing is a general push toward those more economical events. I think you're seeing a general push toward a lot of things. The satellites are up 45% this year over last year. Unbelievable. Huge, huge number of people that are going in there and are trying to qualify for these other events through the satellites and are playing those. I think you're seeing a little bit more money management this year than you have maybe in the last couple of years. But overall, these guys have done a heck of a job. The fact that this thing is bigger than it's ever been before, that the numbers are going to eclipse any previous year for a number of total players, for the total amount of the prize pools put together for the 58 events, it's just phenomenal. I am shocked. I would never have guessed it back in May that it would have been this large.
Yeah, I'm surprised as well. I'm not surprised that they got big numbers in the 1Ks and the 1500s, because that is a lot of recreational players who make it, you know, their one trip to Vegas for the year if they've ever been there before, and they're going to play in those. And also a lot of the online money, the guys who can't grind out online, who maybe now are showing up in the 5-10 cash games, who don't have the bankrolls for $100,000 worth of buy-ins over the summer. Maybe they put together $20,000 or $30,000 that they could use over the course of the summer if they could get their cash off the Internet. I think that that's where a lot of this growth has come from. One of the people who will not be in the main event this year, however, is the godfather of poker, Doyle Brunson, who tweeted just after he was knocked out of the 50K Poker Players Championship this weekend. He tweeted, "No main event for me. Maybe the DOJ will stake me." And then a couple of hours later, he tweeted, "Thanks for all the tweets about my skipping the main event. It's not about money. I've lost a lot of passion for the game since Black Friday." And 2 days before that, he had posted on Twitter saying, "You might be watching my last tournament. If I don't play well, up to my own standards, I may retire from tournament poker." Now, I don't know, Dennis, if you'll remember this, but last year, the week of the main event, or maybe it was right during the main event, we were talking to Mike Sexton on the show, and Doyle had just announced that year that he was not going to be playing the World Series of Poker at all this year. He did go back, and he played in a few events, not a lot, including the 50K and some of the 25Ks and those sort of things. But is it just possible that the stamina it takes to play a tournament that lasts 2 weeks is too much for a 78-year-old poker pro?
Well, that's definitely one part of it. And believe me, my opinion of Doyle couldn't be higher. And if he needs to have enjoyment of the game right now. Now, I have seen him over playing in Bobby's room in the last month. He's played some of the cash games there. I think if he plays in an environment where anytime he wants to, he can get up and leave, relax at it. He's there surrounded by friends. There's no media camera. You wouldn't believe. Anytime he's taking his little scooter and trying to go down the hallway, he gets hounded. There are fans. He tries to be nice to them, the whole bit like that, but he just gets hounded. He cannot get from one table to another without being stopped 10 times.
Yep.
That's got to wear on him after a while. And if he has lost the passion for the game, for the tournament end of it, he is totally entitled. If he wants to make the decision, that's his decision. I absolutely agree with him in that end. I will miss him at it, though. He has been such a fixture. He is such a well-known and such a good spokesman for the game. I'm trying to say this politically correct. But if Black Friday had an influence for driving Doyle Brunson out of the game, that may be one of the worst aspects of Black Friday.
I would agree with that 100%. I don't think that this means that Doyle is going to stop playing poker. He is
absolutely
going to continue playing cash games. I did see in one of the online forums somebody speculating that, oh, there are too many 21-year-olds in the game for a guy like a 78-year-old Doyle Brunson to compete against, to which I'm sure Doyle would say, "I'll be at Bobby's room whenever you want to show up." And I think what you said...
I don't think Doyle is quaking in his shoes.
No, I don't think so either. And I think what you said is so right. I asked the question about the stamina, and that's such an important part of this, because Doyle may be at a point in his life where he doesn't want to have to play a 10-hour, 12-hour day, followed by another 10- or 12-hour day, followed by another, followed by another, followed by another. He may want to be able to pick and choose. You know what? It's Tuesday. I'm going to go play, and I'm going to play 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 hours, maybe make a boatload of cash. Maybe not, but then I can go home and I can hang out and I can jump in my pool, and then tomorrow I can decide if I want to play or not and not feel the obligation of it. In other words, play poker as a pro when he wants to. And remember that this is a guy who did exactly that for 50 years. Played poker
Yep.
when and where he wanted to. The poker tournaments have never been the reason for Doyle Brunson to sit down at a table. Yes, he's got 10 bracelets, but that doesn't define him as a poker player, does it?
Very, very well put. I agree with you 100%. This is Doyle Brunson. Now, whether he plays in the main event or not, it's still Doyle Brunson. And it's a privilege to sit down with a table anywhere with him.
Now, Speaking of definitions, once again this year, the definition of a lady in the ladies' event got expanded to include guys. There were 1,055 players in the 1K ladies' event this weekend. 20 of them were men, although the WSOP in their official statement said there were no men in the ladies' event because a real man knows better. Now, before I talk about the guy who made the final table, I do have to talk about how the ladies' event is different. First of all, as far as I know, it's the only WSOP event in history to have a flash mob. If you haven't seen this, it's on YouTube now. About 80 to 100 women did a flash mob kind of dance thing in the aisle before the tournament started. You'll never see that in another event. That talks about the camaraderie of the women who play in this event. And before that even happened, they had a ceremony on stage led by Poker Hall of Famer Jan Fisher, one of the people behind the Poker Gives organization, and she introduced some of the all-star women of poker, some poker champions, including Jennifer Harmon and Linda Johnson and Jennifer Tilley, who won this event a few years ago, and Vanessa Selps and Susie Isaacs and Cindy Violette and Barbara Enright, who's the only woman in history to make the final table of the main event. That also signifies that you're at a different kind of event, an event where everybody is meant to feel good about what they're doing. As far as I know, it's the only event where when somebody gets knocked out, all the other players applaud for them as if to say, good game, as opposed to, all right, you're out of here, now let's move on to eliminating the rest of the people. There's a real different feeling to this event than anything else. Now, I know you're not one of the guys who would ever enter this thing, but have you ever been down there while the event is going on?
Oh, I have been, absolutely. A friend of mine made the final table last year, Lisa Parsons, then got knocked out on a horrible beat. I was there trying to rail her, and I've been down there while that event's going on, and yes, it is very, very impressive. There's no doubt about it.
Now, as to the guys, there were 20 of them in there, and one of them did make the final table, a guy by the name of Jonathan Epstein. I don't know who the tournament announcer was for this, but at one point he was running down the bios of the nine people who made the final table.
That was Robbie.
Robbie.
Excellent guy.
When Robbie got to introducing Jonathan Epstein, here's what he said. He's single and he's unemployed. No surprise on either count.
He had another one. Yeah, they went through. I mean, there were a bodybuilder, there was a policeman, there were a couple of nurses, there was, you know, all this stuff. For all eight of them, he gets to this Jonathan, whatever the hell his name is, yeah, single and unemployed. Surprise. But
yeah.
I loved it when he got busted out, when this Jonathan character got busted out. Robbie turned around, looked at the table, and said, finally, welcome to the ladies' event.
And at that time, a bunch of the people there in the Thunderdome started singing "Na Na Hey Hey," kissing
yeah,
goodbye.
No,
yeah. Now Arthur Krausen, who writes for one of the online poker sites, actually got Jonathan Epstein and took him aside as he was leaving yesterday, and he asked, you know, what were you doing in this, and why were you doing it? Here's what Epstein said: I figured it wasn't going to be a big deal. He was planning on leaving on Monday, so the ladies' event was the only WSOP tournament that worked with his schedule. He said, I figured it wasn't going to be a big deal, but I was clearly wrong. Obviously, there are a lot of people who are upset. And even though there were people in the audience shouting, beat the dude, beat the dude, he said, the players have been great. Some of the people watching have been kind of rude, but I've just been ignoring them. It's been fine. And then when he was asked his thoughts on ladies-only events, Epstein said, quote, to be honest, in the beginning, I thought it was fine, but now, I don't know. I'm undecided about it. I feel it's somewhat unfair that women get their own event, but I see the reasons behind it. I wonder if he really sees the reason behind this and understands, as I pointed out before, this is a different kind of event.
I don't think he's got a clue. If he did, he would have been apologizing instead of just trying to justify it in that little interview. Maybe someday he'll grow up. Maybe sometime he'll get a wife, and his wife will explain to him the facts of life. We'll see. Or even a girlfriend. Maybe it'd be nice if he actually had one of those.
Maybe. One other thing that Krausen puts in his article He says there may be changes in store for the ladies' event. Caesars Communication Director Seth Polansky thinks men won't be a problem in next year's ladies' event. Quote, a law has recently changed, and we think this issue will be resolved for next year. Have you heard anything about that?
I have not. That news to me, but I would applaud it. And knowing Seth, he is very, very up-to-date, shall we say.
Yeah.
If that's the case and he can implement it, he definitely will.
All right, so that's all we have from the World Series of Poker to start the show today, although I do want to mention that if you're headed for Vegas and want to get into the main event, all day July 6th, there's no new event scheduled for Wednesday, July 6th, but they will be doing megas at 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. And 1 p.m. And 8 p.m. different varieties of buy-ins from 550 to 1060 to 2080 to get more people into the main event. And that's going to go on all day on Wednesday, as it did on Monday when there were no new events scheduled to go on. Also, we talked about the Bad Beat on Cancer free poker seminars that have been going on all during the month in the Brasilia room at the Rio. And they've had Chad Brown and Phil Galfond and Jungle Man Daniel Cates and Vanessa Selbst. Phil Gordon did one. Later this week, on Thursday, they're having Annie Duke. Friday, Annette Oberstad. Saturday, the Mindset Coach, Sam Chahan. And on Sunday, Phil Hellmuth. They're all doing these free, and if you're going to be at the Rio and you want to take advantage of those, you can. And as we mentioned last week when we talked to our friend Vanessa Russo, she's doing her main event prep camp as part of her Big Slick Boot Camp at the Aria this Thursday, starting at 11 o'clock. It's $300 to do a five-hour session with Vanessa and get some main event strategy out of her. Also, a reminder that starting not for the first 2 days of the event, but on day three, which I guess is not until after our show next week. I think it's because, let's see, day 1A is Thursday. So then 1D would be Sunday, then 2A and B would be Monday and Tuesday. So next Wednesday is when they're going to start that streaming of the feature tables of the main event, and they'll keep that going through the 8th. Our friend Kara Scott will be doing that. In fact, we're going to have Kara on next week's show to talk about that. But I also wanted to mention that the $50,000 Poker Players Championship, which is working its way down to the final table today, tomorrow, that will be shown on ESPN3.com. You won't be able to see any hole cards, and it will be on a five-minute delay, but if you want to see the best in the world battling it out at that final table, that'll be another media opportunity for you. What other WSOP stuff do we have to mention? Oh, I got to mention this because we got a tweet from a listener named Vince. I saw that Jonathan Duhamel, like an hour before he went on the air, Dennis, they gave him his bracelet for last year, for winning the main event of the 2010 World Series of Poker. And, of course, if you're not familiar with this, every time they do a bracelet ceremony, which is usually a little bit after the first couple of levels of these tournaments, they do a thing in the pavilion on the stage there with Jack Effel or Nolan Dalla or somebody introducing them. They officially give them their bracelet, and then they play the national anthem of that player's country. So for Jonathan Duhamel, they would play O Canada. For an American player, it would be Star Spangled Banner, etc. So a listener named Vince tweeted to us and said, I was at the Rio last week when they played the American national anthem for the winner. I was happy to see that most people stood up, but I thought it was weird that we were honoring a country that has banned a form of the game we're playing. Just something to think about.
It is. They do so many things right. They have the charity emphasis that they do down there. There are booths down there right now. They're having the talks that all the pros are donating their time for. Vanessa's actually holding another one in November down at the MGM. It's going to be kind of a scavenger hunt to raise funds for cancer research. And she just announced that and asked me to come down there, too, this week to help her work on it. And there's so many things positive about this. It's so much enjoyment. You mentioned the camaraderie that the ladies have and how much enjoyment they have at it and all the people that walk through there and enjoy it and how many millions and millions of people are playing it and how they honor everything. I've gone to a number of charities. I've gone to Washington, D.C. to honor the fallen troops over there. And what do? They want to play a poker tournament. And yet this is the same people that are trying to prohibit us from doing it in our own houses. I don't know. I'm just so disappointed in a number of our reps. I guess that's the light way to say it.
Well, that brings us to the other...
I went on a little hand rage there, but, you know, sorry about that, but it's the truth.
No, well, that brings us to the other really big story that we have to talk about today. By the way, this is the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris in the feature table of Harris St. Louis Poker Room. If you want to catch our shows online, you can always go to thechipleader.com and click on the Final Table Radio Show button. You'll see the blog that contains all of the shows. This is our 127th show over 2.5 years. And on the right side of that page, you'll find all of our previous guests listed. So when you hear us talking about somebody and you want to go back and hear what they actually said, or you miss somebody and you want to hear that show, you can get them there. Or you can always subscribe via iTunes and have each week's show automatically downloaded to you, sometimes with specials that we add for just our podcast listeners. But the other big news of the last few days is that on Thursday, the Alderney Gaming Council, which is based in Ireland, which is the company that, not the company, but the commission that regulates full tilt poker and licensed full tilt poker to allow online poker throughout the world on the full tilt client, they pulled that license. They effectively told full tilt, you're suspended because you've not been able to pay your American players back since June 28th. I'm sorry, since April 15th when Black Friday happened. On June 28th, the AGC suspended Full Tilt's license, which means nobody is allowed to play there. Just yesterday, France also pulled Full Tilt's license, although I don't think Full Tilt was operating in France as PokerStars is, as a legally licensed operator there. But there is a hearing that's scheduled for July 26th, that is 3 weeks from today. Between last week, June 28th, and July 26th, no one is going to be able to play on Full Tilt Poker or cash out of Full Tilt Poker. And I'm not just talking about Americans. I'm talking about everyone on the planet Earth who has money on Full Tilt Poker cannot get it back until this is fully resolved. Now, you probably know a little bit more about this because you've been following the legal side of this, and I'm not sure how much you can tell us and how much you can't tell us, but fill us in on what you know, Dennis.
Well, again, it was a huge disappointment to see that. Wasn't a real surprise, to be honest. The failure to answer the questions, the failure to follow the script that PokerStars wrote was obviously a big blow to Full Tilt. I do know that they are trying their best to come up with some solution for it. This is just another detriment, shall we say. It's been announced. Don't know a lot of the details, but somebody's trying to buy it. Again, I don't know whether that will happen or not. One of the terms of buying it that they insisted upon is that the American players get paid back immediately through, a fund. Well, we'll see what happens there. I hope something comes forth. I hope that this class action suit that also has been filed on behalf of the players never goes anywhere. Not for sure what the end result is going to be. It's not good for poker. It's not good for poker players. It needs to be cleared up, and I just hope they can find a resolution to it. If years ago the U.S. government had done what they should have done and come forward with clear regulations for this, and a clear guideline to follow, this would never have happened. So I'm not trying to justify any actions from any of the companies, but I'm telling you that had the U.S. government not had this gray area and had they come forward with clear regulations on how people are supposed to proceed, this would never have happened. So I think there's plenty of blame to go around here, and I don't let the guys in Washington off the hook. Sorry,
I don't.
They should have stepped up to the plate. They should have done something for this. They did not do it, and this is some of the end result.
Absolutely, and when they passed the UIGA in the middle of the night without anybody really knowing what they were signing off on, that was absolutely ridiculous. However,
yes,
I think that there is still a lot of blame that has to go to everybody at Full Tilt Poker, from Ray Bittar on down to the people who were owners of this site, who were consultants to the site, who were directors of the site, whoever they are, because as you pointed out, PokerStars did things right. And I'm not saying this because Dennis has had a three-year association with PokerStars. As we pointed out before, the death of any poker site is not a good thing because it hurts poker players. But let's be honest here. The people at Full Tilt Poker did not follow the PokerStars model of ensuring that player funds were always separated from company funds, for ensuring that whenever there was a question, a line drawn in the sand legally, that they were on the right side of that line, that they did not make sure that they always had enough funds on hand to be able to pay their players back when their players wanted to withdraw their money. I'm talking about before Black Friday. These were problems that were inherent in what was going on at Full Tilt Poker. We didn't know about it because it's a private company and all of their in-house accounting was private. But once Black Friday came around, and now week after week after week, I think we're in 11 weeks now since Black Friday, Full Tilt Poker has done a terrible job of taking care of its players. I know the DOJ shut them down, but there has been virtually no communication from Full Tilt to its players for several weeks now, either as a public thing or on the Full Tilt website or through the online forums like 2+2 and Poker Road, there through the poker media. We have not heard one word from Full Tilt or its top people about what was going on. And if you're a consumer of a company and that company has your money in their pocket, and we're not just talking about people who had $100 or $200 or $500 on there. You had some people who had thousands of dollars on there, who foolishly may have kept their life roll, if you will, on the Full Tilt because that's where they played, particularly some of these high-stakes players, but even the recreational players. For you to be able to not get an answer out of the company about what's happening with your money. This is not just about a company going out of business. This is a company going out of business while holding on to your money. I think that the blame has to be aimed first and foremost at those people who made those decisions along the way, regardless of what Congress was doing, which we don't appreciate or approve of. PokerStars found the right way to do it. Full Tilt and, frankly, some others chose the wrong way to do it, and I don't think we can let them off the hook for that.
Well, I'm not trying to let anybody off the hook. I'm just saying there's plenty of blame to go around. But this is just a end result of a lot of misjudgment and people not doing their job. Was there some mismanagement and everything? Well, obviously there was. The ramifications are now coming forward. But my bottom line still is, some way, some shape, somehow, the money that the people have on that site has to get back in their hands. I'm not too sure how we're going to arrive at that or what it is, but everyone should be working toward that, including the DOJ. Now, irregardless of worrying about everything else, find a way to get the people their money back. That
right.
should be their number one concern.
Well, that's why I was curious why you said you hope that the class action lawsuit doesn't go forward. These guys who have filed it on behalf of themselves and everybody else, they're saying, hey, Full Tilt has $150 million worth of player money. We want it back.
No, what I said was, I hope there's no need for the class action suit to go forward.
Ah, I see.
Big, big difference.
Yeah, that is a big difference.
If the money is refunded, that eliminates the lawsuit. There is no reason for it. So let's hope that through investment, through whatever, some way or other, they find a way to get it taken care of.
Yep. This lawsuit, by the way, was filed last Thursday in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. That's exactly where these DOJ offices are, where the U.S. attorney shut things down on Black Friday, and it's filed not just against Ray Bittar and Nelson Burtnick, the executives who run Full Tilt, but also a lot of members of Team Full Tilt, including Howard Lederer and Phil Ivey and Chris Ferguson and John Juwanda and Jen Harmon and Phil Gordon and Eric Lindgren and Eric Seidel and Andy Block and Mike Mattisau and Gus Hansen and Alan Cunningham and Patrick Antonius. They are all named in there, plus John Doe's, which means that they can add other names in there later. So in that... With that information out there, I got to go back to something I asked you at the beginning of the World Series, which is, are there still people wearing Full Tilt patches at the World Series of Poker? Because when I was there, I did see Alan Cunningham and Steve Zolotow and maybe one or two others wearing them. I can't imagine that anybody would be wearing them today.
No, but to be honest, every now and then you still see a full tilt hat or a full tilt shirt or a full tilt backpack or whatever there. But its presence is very, very minimal now. And I'm not for sure you'll see any of the patches or anything like that for the main event after these last happenings. They're definitely disappearing.
Yep. I'd be surprised if even European players who have been happily going along pretending that everything was okay, if they're going to do that now that they know that their money is locked up. I mean, there were something like 13,000 people on full tilt when the AGC handed down its ruling and full tilt shut things off and said, sorry, we're having some technical problems or whatever it was, maintenance or whatever they claimed. There were people in the middle of cash games and tournaments who may not have known what the heck is happening. They thought, you know, I've lost my internet connection or whatever. Those people are not going to be fans of full tilt, just like the American players who can't get their money back.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing of it is, and the DOJ has to recognize this, all there is a shuffling around. People are planning other places to play. They're not going to stop playing poker. Again, if they just would do their job and get it regulated so that everybody can be safe and comfortable and just enjoy the game, that's what we need. You're not going to stop poker from being played. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
So
hopefully we can get to a point where we can play it both live and in person and online as well. But as I said,
absolutely,
I still think that that's a long way off, and this doesn't help. This doesn't help
No.
the cause of poker at all. And again, our bottom line on this show isn't choosing one site or another or preferring that you play somewhere or don't play somewhere. It's, look, if you have money online and you can't get it back and you're a poker player, we feel your pain. And we know that there are thousands, if not tens of thousands of people who are in the same situation you are. And it's not just full tilt. The people who are on UB and AP are feeling
yep.
that pain as well. And by the way, speaking of customer service, I haven't heard a word out of them either. Have you?
Nope, nothing. They're so much smaller of a site, maybe that's why they're kind of getting ignored right now. But there's an awful lot of people that played on those other sites that are also in trouble and are also not seen any of their money. So for all the poker players, we should say, whatever site you're playing on, hopefully we'll get this resolved.
You know, if those sites make up 20% of the business that Full Tilt made up, that's still $30 million that's locked up that players aren't getting back that could be in the poker economy, which is why I find it even more amazing that the WSOP has had the summer it's had.
This is true. I think
yeah.
the people at the WSOP are amazed they've had this kind of summer.
I think they are, too. All right, I'm going to let you go. I know you want to run off and get into that late registration for the 1500 today down at the Rio. Good luck in that. It has not been a great summer for either of us, so I hope that you can turn things around and get things off to a good start. And then you are playing the main event this year?
Yes, I'm playing on Saturday, 1C. I'll be playing the main event. Several others, I've talked to a few of my friends. Chris Moneymaker's going to play that day. There'll be pro scattered on all 4 days, though, of course. You come down any day to the Rio, you'll find some people you've seen on TV. No doubt about it.
All right. And next week when we do the show, if we've timed it correctly, you should be able to talk about how you made it through the first 2 days and you're roaring into day three with a big stack, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Go take him down, Dennis. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
Here's my partner, Dennis Phillips, in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris in the poker room of Harrah's St. Louis. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Tony Dunst, who you know from the Raw Deal segments on the WPT telecast on the Fox Sports Net on Sunday nights. He's got some advice for people who are headed to the WSOP main event for the first time, or maybe you just want some basic strategy. He's got some of that and some words on how he thinks he did in his inaugural year on TV. That's ahead as the final table continues here on Five Night of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com, with our podcast via iTunes and on thechipleader.com.
Kits, does your granny lend you money? Well, this granny does. And right now, calling 800-GRANNY-8 will get you $50,000 for just $238 per month. Call 800-GRANNY-8. Get a low fixed rate and take a three-month payment break. That's 90 payment-free days to get your finances straight. Our customers are saving hundreds per month, and our friendly loan officers make it easy. Call 800-GRANNY-8 or apply online at granny8.com.
Great mortgage rates, call 800-GRANNY-8.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, brought to you by Harrah's St. Louis. I am Paul Harris. I was down here a couple times in the past week, once playing in a PLO game and once playing in a tournament on Saturday afternoon. Harrah's had its monthly $310 buy-in Saturday afternoon tournament and worked my way through the field there and ended up heads up against a guy who had two moves to him, all in or fold. He wasn't interested in doing much post-flop play. It was going to be all in or fold on every hand. And we were pretty even in chips, and then the deck hit him a little bit on some successive hands, and he ended up taking it down. I finished in second place, and frankly, since I hadn't played a tournament since the circuit event here at Harrah's back in April, I wasn't particularly unhappy with my play. I thought I did okay, and nice to take down second in that event that weekend. It's just one of the many tournaments they run here on a regular basis. That 310 is a monthly thing that goes on the first Saturday of every month. Every other Saturday during the month, they run a $125 buy-in at 2 o'clock on Saturday. And every other day of the month, Sunday through Friday, they do two tournaments a day. You can get in here for, I think, 10 of them at just a $60 buy-in. So if you're listening to us this afternoon, you work a 9-to-5 job, come on in here and play the 7 o'clock event tonight. They get at least 50 players in there. The 1 o'clock event today had more than that because they let alternates in as well. And they've also got a 125 on Friday nights and 160 on Thursday nights. And a lot of regular tournament action going on here in addition to the regular cash action. So if you're in St. Louis, this is the place to play. And if you're coming to St. Louis, go to harrahs.com/stlpoker, find out the schedule, and find out when the game and tournament you want to play is available. Also, while you're here, you can check out the new piano bar. They've got dueling pianos here. This is the only place in St. Louis that I know has this little twist for date night or bachelorette party or just going out and doing a little sing-along. The piano bar only at Harrah's, plus all the great restaurants here. So Harrah's St. Louis, we're proud to call it our home for the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Later on, we're going to bring you a web extra for our podcast listeners. That'll be Dwight Pilgrim, the guy who shocked the world earlier this year by taking down a WPT event. But right now, here's WPT Raw Deal segment host Tony Dunst in an interview we recorded out at the Rio. Roll it. Joining us now is Tony Dunst, who had a pretty good 2010 at the World Series of Poker, finished 50th in the main event, four other cashes for a total of almost $200,000. Then he was hired by the World Poker Tour to do some hand analysis on each week's broadcast throughout Season 9 in a segment called The Raw Deal, which when I heard about it, I said, perfect pick, and it has worked out tremendously. Tony, welcome back to the Final Table, because we had you on as you were starting the season, and now afterwards I can say you did a great job. Congratulations on that.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Was it what you expected, or was there anything different there? I think it very much was along the lines of what I expected. I had a sense that I was going to have a couple of minutes of time. I knew that most of the writing was going to be for me to fill in, so basically they usually pick out the hands or the sort of concept they would like me to talk about, and it's my job to fill in the rest, and I had some, you know, experience in presentation and in writing, so it kind of turned out close to how I envisioned it, though now and then my editors and my producers will sneak in there, something in there that I really appreciate that I just didn't know was coming, and I'll just think, oh man, they got that one right.
What kind of feedback did you get from players, particularly from pros who you may have been a little rough on for some of their bad decisions?
Let's see.
And by the way, we all make bad decisions.
Yeah, that's just that's part of the game.
But we don't have somebody televising them and using a telestrator to point out, here's where you went wrong.
Exactly. Yeah, I make all kinds of bad decisions too. So, let's see. There was one guy who took his discontent to Twitter. That was Nikolai Yakovenko. He was not pleased with my comments. No one else that I had critical things to say of has ever given me any feedback. I think that in really all the segments, I never said anything personally aggressive. I always just said, what are you doing with this play? Like, I really just tried to make it honest as opposed to slanted in some way that was just trying to be irksome. Mm-hmm. Well, and I know you've got to be a little careful there because you're not the one sitting at the table. There may be a reason behind the madness.
Right, exactly.
Absolutely. So you've got to qualify it a little bit there. The move may not look good, but it may be there may be justification behind it. I know I've made some dumb moves. I've made some calls sometimes because I want to see those cards for later knowledge.
Yeah, poker's an incomplete information game as it is, and then when you're doing commentary, you've got even less to go on, and you don't know the history between everyone and all the factors that went into their decision-making, so you're kind of dealing with things in a vacuum.
Have you had anybody come up to you since then and say, you know what, thanks for pointing that out, I watched it and I didn't even see that?
Nobody that I commented in a hand on, though other people that have watched the segment say, oh, you've clued me into some things that I didn't really know were going on in poker.
And here's the most important part, what's it done for your game?
What has it done for my game? I'm not quite sure yet.
I love it.
No, really, it's not a joke or anything. Like, it's interesting to think about how people are reacting to me differently. People are now more aware of what kind of factors I'm thinking about, you know, how deep my thought process is. Conversely, I don't know how people who are random or less serious players are going to see me in terms of, you know, how deep am I thinking? Do they feel like because I can talk about all this stuff that I'm really in their head in the middle of a hand, but really I'm just, you know, another guy playing his cards. So I haven't had a chance to really go out there and experience what it's like yet because I've played an occasional WPT event here and there, but I haven't played a ton of volume lately.
Oh, here we are sitting at the World Series of Poker. We always like to ask our guests about their first experience. When's the first time you came to WSOP, and what was it like for you?
I came originally in 2006. I played 10 events, and I bricked the first nine and just had, like, atrocious beats throughout them. And then the 10th event, which was the main, it was the biggest year when there was almost, like, 9,000 entrants. And I ended up running very deep and finishing, like, 198th on a bad beat. And I remember the memory that stuck out the most from that event was that I took a perfect in the main event on day two. We had like a jack seven deuce flop, and the other guy had sixes, and we got it in on a six turn, and he slammed out the river six for an awful lot of chips. But then, you know, I just kept coolering people, and it went on for a while. So
Running that deep, it's awfully hard to run that deep in that big of a tournament. Coming up to the main event here, got a lot of people here for the first time. Do you have any words of wisdom of what do you do that day one and day two of the main event? How do you survive it? Do you have any special philosophy there?
You know, my philosophy would be very different for myself as opposed to someone in their first time. I would take a different approach from them. Generally, I would advise them to try and evaluate how much gamble they should take based on their table. There are going to be quite a number of soft tables in the main event. I would think less so this year than in previous years with everything that's happened, but there's still going to be some excellent value tournaments, so tables. So if you feel like on day one you happen upon a table that was especially difficult, I'm not opposed to playing more risk-averse poker in hopes of, in the next day or perhaps the third day, or, you know, getting moved at some point to a table that's going to be a lot softer. And, you know, generally, especially just day one, I feel like there are enough people around that kind of want to donate stacks that I'm very rarely making huge gambles at that point in the tournament.
So do you find that there are more people who are there gambling too much early on, or too many people, particularly rookies, who are playing scared poker, and you're taking advantage of that aspect of it?
There's a combination of both, and it's kind of up to you to recognize which or which once you get to the table. I would say these days it's more likely you're going to get people who play scared and weak tight as opposed to people who are just going to implode stacks to the tune of 10,000.
Mm-hmm. Are you wide-scoped on your different games? Do you play Raz, Deuce of Seven, Triple Draw? Do you play the whole variety? Do you like to play Horse? What's your variety of games? What are your top games?
I'm entirely useless at everything outside of No Limit Hold'em tournaments. I'm okay at No Limit Cash. I play, like, you know, 5-10 live. Played probably, like, 1-2 online when that was going. And when they have, like, Pot Limit Hold'em events here at the series, those are good value. And something like the 1500 limit tends to attract enough people that are very bad at limit to make up for people who, like myself, are just playing bad at limit.
Yeah.
I love the way he qualifies it. The very bad ones as opposed to only the bad.
It's,
and,
you know,
and unfortunately, I know what he's talking about.
You know exactly what I'm talking about. Like, there's just tons of guys who almost never play limit who will show up specifically because it's a bracelet event and are very, very uncomfortable and inexperienced in that game. So I did seriously approach limit for about 18 months, like 5 years ago, and read plenty of Skolansky and still can think about hand reading and value betting and calling with pot odds and everything like that. So I feel okay in that field, but certainly I know some of the guys who are really excellent at the game, and I'm not happy when I'm at their table. But
yeah, it's always fun to see somebody who specializes in one game, and usually that one game at first was no limit, and now they're trying to play something else. Mm-hmm. In my case, it's pot limit. I love to see a no-limit player sitting down in his first few PLO games and thinking, you know, those aces, those kings that you love so much in your other game are so valuable in this game, which, of course, they're not.
Not so much this time around.
There's so much room for exploitation there. Absolutely love it. We're not going to get into Black Friday policy and that sort of stuff.
Sure.
But you were known as an online pro, as Bond 18 Online.
Yes.
What's your career plan now, Tony?
Yes, I agree. My identity has been robbed from me. And my career. My career plan is to play a lot of 5-10 around Las Vegas, where I live. I'm going to do a lot of writing. I'm considering trying to write a book or get a book published. Just, it's always been a fascination of mine, writing, and now seems like a better time than ever with everything that's happened. I'm going to travel around with the World Poker Tour quite extensively and keep working for them. I've been told that there's going to be expanded radio coverage coming in Season 10.
Wow.
And
let me just stop you right there.
Sure.
What does that mean, expanded?
That I can't specify on, not because I don't want to, but because I don't know. I've just been told that it's going to be expanded.
You're getting more time,
yeah,
obviously.
I really don't know what it means, but I love that job. I have a blast with it.
Well, the book you mentioned, I'm always curious about it. Do you have a particular slant or a particular view that you want to express? Or, I mean, is this going to be strictly poker and poker strategy? Is it going to be a life type of one? What type of a book are we talking about here?
Well, the idea I came up with was something along these lines, which is basically I wanted it to be a book comprised of short stories that were extensively researched so I could fill in the most interesting and peculiar details from all the various things that I'd taken a fascination in or experienced over the last 6 years and really elaborate on the story. So I kind of want to take, you know, like my, I'm not sure if you guys have ever looked over my blog, my content is very much sort of oriented towards a younger male audience as far as, you know.
You think?
Yeah. As far as the kind of topics and conversation and everything there and how the protagonist behaves, it's very younger male oriented. So I thought, you know, it'd be fun to have those kind of stories, but woven with a more intellectual and researched approach, something like, say, Bill Bryson approach to like a younger man's stories, but on the topics that they would find fascinating and interesting, but, you know, with my usual demand of radical honesty, you know, just it purely, entirely accurate facts that I could put in there. I wouldn't want to exaggerate or distort anything. I would just want to write something that was 100% of my life experience mixed with research.
Yeah. I want to go back to something because I'm a 5-10 cash game player myself. You're going to play a lot of that here in Vegas.
Fair bit.
Where have you found the games to be softest? Where do you find them to be hardest?
I've played like 4 sessions. So, so I'm not the right guy to ask.
Quick, up or down?
Yeah, I'm up a few $1,000 over the course of those 4
sessions.
Because there are differences in the games here. You know, the Bellagio 5-10 game is capped at a $1,500 buy-in. You go over to the Wynn or the Venetian, and it's uncapped, and you get different levels of grinders coming in there. And frankly, I don't need another really good player sitting down in those games, so...
Well, you're in luck because the WPT is going to keep me very busy over the next few months. You know, we're going to have more events coming up. They've expanded things this season, added stuff in Florida. I'm going to be moving around with them more in the upcoming season. So I don't think I'm going to be running into you in the 5-10 very frequently.
Do you play every WPT event?
Pretty much. If it's a main event, then I make a point of playing it. I have a long-standing backing arrangement with a friend of mine, and in the event that we have a peculiar event like the 25K championship, where we both agree that it's really tough and we don't want to necessarily tack 25K worth of makeup onto the stake, we can decide to opt out, sell a bunch of percent as I did this time around, just to make sure I get myself in the event. I mean, I love the play, so I don't ever want a passive event, and if there's people who think that I'm positive EV in it, then man, count me in.
I want to pull a little bit of a switch. They're changing some of the ESPN coverage this year, and they're doing the webcam. And from days 3 through 8, they're going to have a 30-minute delay on the two feature tables, switching back and forth every 30 minutes from the two tables. And they're going to be showing a lot of hold cards at this time. Good idea? Bad idea?
I've heard about that, and I was thinking about it. Are the people who are going to be showing their cards half an hour to 60 minutes later, are they going to be sequestered somewhere?
No, they're not.
No.
Now, as the PCA, what PokerStars did down there, mm-hmm. they sequestered the final table,
right.
and then it was broadcast to the rest of the Atlantis and the rest of the world, basically,
yeah.
and everybody could do it. But they were sequestered. Their computers were confiscated.
No cell phones.
Cell phones were
right.
taken away. And once you left the room, if for any reason, made no difference, if you physically left the room, you were not allowed back in.
That seems like the way to approach things if you're going to do something like this. Otherwise, you have the dilemma of people being able to find out what the guy did 60 minutes ago in that huge pot we played.
35 minutes ago.
You know, and that is going to be problematic for a lot of people.
It's going to change the dynamics of the game some. It's similar to what, you know, showing the whole cards on. It's where you can see what somebody did, and then you can play against him in another tournament.
Right.
Now then, you can see and find out what how a guy played against you, you know, 10 hands ago.
Yes.
Huge difference.
It is. I don't feel that strongly about it either way, but I know that other people will.
Oh.
I know that some people are going to be really pissed off at the idea. I've been turning my cards face up for so long that I don't care if people find out how I'm playing. So it doesn't fuss me, but I know a lot of people are going to be pissed.
Okay. Yeah, we've talked to other pros, and some of them said no problem. Some of them said big problem. The ones who said no problem see it as a possible image enhancement. They can do something now and have somebody think that they can use it against them, almost like a 30-minute reverse
sell. We're just adding more levels.
Yeah, like we need more levels in poker.
Yeah.
Right. Because my brain hurts enough.
this spring at the WPT Championship at the Bellagio, Scott Seaver took it down, the 25K title.
Mm-hmm.
You've known him for several years.
Several years, yeah.
He's a guy who I really wasn't aware of until I saw him on the big game, the PokerStars TV show last year, where I was really, really impressed with him. Tell us a little bit about what you know of his game and how he's really, an emerging superstar.
Absolutely. I mean, Scott, outside of just being an awesome guy, has been one of the most winning players online across a spectrum of games, tournaments, cash games, a little bit of nosebleed experience, not sure how much, but definitely some. He's friends with other guys who are considered really geniuses of the game, like Ike Haxton and Justin Bonomo, and they all live over at Panorama, or have lived over at Panorama, and spent a lot of time strategizing together. And, you know, his win in that event was by no means a surprise to me. He's had some other solid live results leading up to this, and this was, thus far, the largest stage he's done it on. So for guys in my circle of friends, Scott pulling out that win was kind of like, of course he did.
Well, I've played Scott a couple of different times. He made one of the best moves that I've ever seen at a tournament. It was at an NAPT at the Mohegan Sun, and it was just a phenomenal play. A gentleman was slow playing. He'd flopped trips. On the queens. I knew Scott didn't have the other queen because I mucked it pre-flop.
Right.
I was upset until I saw some of the action in the end result. As it turned out, he had pocket threes. He played it through. A three came on the river. The guy finally made a decent bet. He'd been slow playing the queens there. And Scott shoved.
Like a huge overshove, right?
Four times what's in the pot. And this guy just goes, what the, you know, type deal, and tanked and tanked and tanked and tanked and finally called him.
Yeah. He gets in people's heads.
He did. He turned over the boat then. He hit it on the river, that three. He had pocket threes. Boom, he has the boat. Killed the guy, caught the two-outer on the river. Not only caught it, but then got paid off monstrously.
He got me to pay off with top pair real hard in the LAPC. He check-raised me on the river, and I called down like a donk against him, partially just because it's Scott Seaver, and I know he can do sick stuff, but he gets in your head, man.
It worked well, and I was shocked when he turned over those threes. Because I knew he didn't have the queen. I thought, this guy calls him, he's dead meat.
Yeah.
So, I was wrong. Absolutely.
Tony, before we let you go, tell us about the poker documentary that you're part of.
Yes.
Boom, is it called?
Boom, it's called. And, you know, if Black Friday had any fortunate result, it's that it made the storyline of that movie more interesting. Basically, these guys contacted me a little bit after the World Series last year and right around the announcement of the WPT gig and said we were considering having you as one of our sort of major protagonists in this documentary, Boom. And these were the guys who had done the Busto to Robusto series about Andrew Roble and Captain Zebo. And I thought that the production quality and everything they'd done there as far as really looking at the story of the person in both online poker was excellent. So I said, yeah, consider me very interested. A couple months later, he said, sure, you've been selected. So he started filming me at the LAPC, got both a look at sort of how I live my daily life, how I do my thing with the raw deal, what's happening in the poker world and the economy, tried to get them introduced to the various people in the WPT who have been really accommodating about the whole project. And so we got a lot of great interviews with our staff and people around the industry about how online poker was birthed and developed developed and how this whole industry came to be. And then, of course, as everyone knows, it came crashing down on April 15th, and now he's following that side of the story. And one of the other main characters is this woman, Danielle, who's a stay-at-home mom, and you know, she lives up in Minnesota where there's not necessarily a ton of game availability, and this has been her entire life and was the sole income for her husband and family, and you know, just really allows to show a human side of the online poker story that's being discussed in numbers and figures and online companies that are a million miles away in the newspaper, but has this human element now through this film.
When's it coming out?
Early 2012. Right. And you know, what we're really excited about is that when we saw the trailer, it just it looked like he nailed it. You know,
yeah.
I was really happy.
Can I buy 535 copies and send them to certain people in Washington?
I think that you can. I could probably arrange that for you.
It's called Boom, and it'll be out next year. You can see the trailer on YouTube
right
now.
I should make sure I have a meltdown scene, you know, just
there
to really get the tearjerkers out in the end. No, I think Danielle's going to be the tearjerker, and I'm the eternal optimist. They, like, took online poker away, and I'm like, huh, all right, more free time. Sounds good. This is inconvenient.
Okay, cancel my order.
Yeah.
That's Tony Dunst, the guy behind the Raw Deal segments on the FSN broadcast of the World Poker Tour on Sunday nights. Glad to hear that there'll be more of him next season. And now we move on to another guy who's got some advice for you on the main event and lots of other stuff to talk about. A guy by the name of Dwight Pilgrim, who earlier this year said to everybody he was going to shock the world and did exactly that on a WPT telecast. I'm going to let Dennis run down some of his credits for you.
This year, listen to this. Final table at the WPT at the Bellagio last month. 10th in that six-handed event at the WPT in Florida in April. You final tabled the Borgata in April. Final table at a WPT event at Hollywood Poker Open in April. A final table at the WSOP circuit event in San Diego, the regional championship. That was back in March. Second in the big event in the bike in March, and second in the six-handed event at the LAPC in February. You now have 50 caches, 8 first place, winnings in excess of $1.7 million, and that's only in the last 3 years. Are you on a little roll here?
I'm just trying to be as consistent as I can. You know, I'm going out there playing an event, trying to put myself in the best situation to be successful. It's 51, but who's counting?
Congratulations.
Thank you.
A lot of people who may not have known about you, Dwight, saw you on the WPT telecast aired about 6 weeks ago, where you shocked the world, and at the end kind of broke down. You were really, really emotional at the end. Tell us a little bit about that experience from your perspective and what you were thinking as you watched it on TV.
Oh, that game was a crazy game for me. You know, at that point, I was going after Play of the Year, Card Play of the Year, WPT Play of the Year, Bluff Play of the Year. I actually moved into the number one play in the world, and at the time, when I was showing. So, you know, a lot of different things happened at the same time. I turned into number one play in the world. I had a chance to win my first big major title. You know, I had a chance to take the monkey off my back, as they would say, you know. So that was a great game for me. As for watching it, you know, it was a beautiful thing. It's my first time seeing myself on TV, get to see how the public view me. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people had some negative things to say. A lot of people had some positive things to say. But at the end of the day, I feel like, you know, I didn't disrespect anybody. And, I had to put myself in the best position to be successful. And I know talking is part of my game, so I had to bring that out there.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I should call you, I guess, a rookie at this, beyond when you compare it to a lot of the old pros that have been around this thing for 20 or 30 years. I'm sorry, with your winnings and how you've done this month after month after month, you're not a rookie anymore. All right, you've definitely moved up there. How do you move that fast? 3 years into this, 51 caches already? I mean, do you have any secrets? What was the background? What brought you forward so fast?
My background, you know, I was a loan officer growing up, so I had to do a lot of different things. You know, I had to build up a lot of different a lot of different characteristics in myself to make me, you know, a better person. And, you know, I had a lot of big responsibilities at the time. So, you know, I think that transferred over into poker. You know, a lot of guys that's coming up in this age are younger, you know, 23, 24, 25. I'm 28. You know, I've seen a different path. You know, I had a different walk of life. So, you know, the different things I've known and different things I've been through transfer over into my poker game. You know, and it's about wanting to win. You know, I think I have a different a different desire than most guys. You know, I want to be the best. I want to go to the Hall of Fame. I want to be one of the greatest players, you know. So I think my drive is one of the difference makers that brings me to the next level.
And to follow up with that, you Rams, a lot of times I people ask me questions like that, and I say, well, some of my life experiences have really helped me out. It's really kept me grounded. It's helped me to analyze the situation and do bankroll management and all the basic stuff there. You kind of touched upon that. I mean, could you have done what you're doing now when you were 21, 22, 23? Could you have had that kind of success, do you think?
Oh, no way. You know, I was a different man at 21, 22. I was a different mind frame. You know, I didn't want the same things for myself. I didn't want, you know, I probably didn't have the capacity to want these great things. You know, I had to see more things. I had to learn more things. I had to see people out there doing better than me. I had to see people out there doing worse than me. I had to see where I wanted to put myself in life, you know, so at 21, those things wasn't on my mind. You know, I had other things on my mind. You know,
girls, you know.
I probably wanted to chase the girls more than I wanted to be the greatest player in the world.
That's crazy talk for a 21-year-old.
Oh, my God.
A 21-year-old is thinking like that, right? What are you, nuts? Let's talk a little bit about the reaction you mentioned. Some positive, some negative to what people saw you doing on TV. Because you kind of like to get in people's faces at the table. Now, I've never sat down at a table with you, so I've never seen you do this live. But I'm curious about the reaction you get when it's not on TV and when you're sitting there and you're, you know, it's a full ring to start off a tournament. You got 10 people there, and obviously you're sizing people up, and you decide, here's a guy I'm going to go off a little bit. Talk about how that part of your strategy works, because the verbal part is definitely part of your poker game, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But, you know, you can't really get caught up in the verbal thing in the beginning of a tournament because that's really irrelevant. You know, when a guy has 200 big blinds, he's not emotionally intact in the game. You know, when a guy has 17 big blinds, his emotions are in the game. So it's different points of the games where the verbal or you could pick up reads or you can even get information. How can you pick up a read on a guy that has 250 big blinds? You can, but it would be easier if he had 25 big blinds and he makes that raise and he's nervous, yeah, and everything's on the line. You have 250 big blinds. You make a raise. You got 248 left. You know? It's like, what's the big deal? You're not going to see a guy scared right there.
So are you talking more on day two?
I'm talking more on day three. That's what I'm talking the most. On day three, watch out. A million chips. I feel like I'm going all the way. You know, confidence is a big part of this game, you know. When you're in a position where you have a chance to be more successful with a lot of chips in front of you, you have a good table draw, you feel comfortable, you feel like you're ready to take it to the next level, it could come out a little bit. You know, so on day three with a million chips, I'm ready to go, I'm ready to take out whoever's in front of me and make it happen.
What happens if the reverse happens on day three and you're the one with 15 big blinds and such? How do you handle that emotion?
Well, I'm great with 15 big blinds. You know, I'm one of the best in the world with 15 big blinds. So it doesn't matter if I have 150 big blinds or have 15 big blinds, you know. At any part of the tournament, any level, that's what I'm ready for, 15 big blinds. I'm ready to go there with 15 big blinds and get to 30, slow it down and get to 40, and get to 50, and get yourself back in a position to play. But 15 big blinds, that's a great stack. You got to be able to work that stack. So it doesn't matter where I'm at in chip style because I'm ready for all different situations. But it's more about the table draw and who's there and what's going on and, you know, what they'll let you get away with, because that's what poker's mostly about. What would the other guy let you get away with?
We're talking with Dwight Pilgrim here at the final table, Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris at the World Series of Poker in Las Vegas. We have a lot of people who don't play big tournaments. They play small tournaments, $60 buy-ins, $150 buy-ins, that sort of stuff. And I know they're listening to you and saying, how do you survive as a short stack player like that? 12, 14, 15, 18 big blinds. Can you explain a little bit to them what the strategy should be so that they can emulate how you do it?
Well, that's where I started, $60 tournaments. The day after, I won $760,000. The next day, I bubbled a $120 tournament. You know, with ace-queen, the guy had ace-jack, and he had the jack on the river, and I was the bubble boy. With those kind of tournaments, I say you just play strong. Doesn't matter if you're playing a $60 tournament, you're playing a $10,000 tournament. There's certain things you have to do in a tournament to be successful, you know, and get to the next level. Thing and advice I could say is if you're going to play a game, play it to the highest level you can. Try to take it serious. Play it like a $10,000 tournament. Don't say, all right, it's a $6 tournament, I could get knocked out. Play it the same way you would play a $10,000 tournament. Ask yourself questions. What makes me a good player? What makes a good player a good player? Don't get confused. There's a lot of people confused. A good player, he's going out there, he's raising everybody, stealing everybody, he's taking everybody, he's bringing things down, he's stealing, he's robbing, he's taking. A good player has it most of the time. When he puts his money in, a good player has it. So I say you focus on what makes yourself a good player and try to figure out things you could do to put yourself in a better situation and make yourself a better player.
One of the things I do, it's kind of the reverse. If you had somebody at your table that only had 12, 14, 15 big blinds, then how would you play? You know, there's a power to the short stack because he can shove it any time, and you've got to be careful with that and the moves you make against him. I do the reverse then. I try to imagine that if I was in his position and what kind of hands I would be shoving with, what kind of hands I would be calling. Would I play a position here where I think people will fold because they worry about me shoving, that type of a deal. And then, if I can analyze what I would be doing in his situation, that helps me then to play against him.
But that might hurt you because you got to realize this guy isn't thinking like Dennis. I go bring you up a 22-year-old boy.
You have to know your players. You're so fond of saying, you can't make a move against a guy who has no idea what a move is.
Right.
If he's playing it and he has an ace in his hand and there's an ace on the board, that's all he's thinking. He doesn't think of you, your hand, the chip stack, whatever. I got aces. Wow. And that's the level he plays. So that's an excellent point that Dwight's bringing up.
You might have 14 big blinds and see the 10 jack. And say, I'm going to find a better spot. And if you're thinking, this kid is probably going to fold a 10-jack there. And this kid is like, this is a 10-jack. I'm connected. I'm close. I'm jack high. So some people that say, the 10-jack, I haven't hit this in a long time. You don't know what this guy's thinking.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of people don't think on the right ethics of the game.
There are guys who will insta-muck that jack 10 in that situation when they're short stack. And there are other guys who will 4-bet all in with that jack 10.
A lot of guys that's going to... More guys just 4-betting all in with that jack 10 than more guys just folding, I'll tell you that now.
And how many times have you sat at a table and you're maybe not even involved in the hand, and at the end of it, they each turn over the few cards and you go, what the?
That happened all the time. Most of the time it's me.
I love it.
Yeah, but you're not just catching cards there and getting lucky when you're running this deep in this many tournaments. You're having an unbelievable year. So congratulations on that. You guys, just before the World Series started this year, you both took part in the fantasy draft.
Okay.
And I wasn't there, but Dennis told me that you had the first pick. And, talk about shock the world. We've had this guy on the show, and he's a terrific player, but you chose Baseball-y, Eric Baldwin, as the first pick overall. Why?
It's all about, what do you feel and how do you feel about what's going on? I had my chance to build my team. My team is my team. I didn't want to go out and get Eric Seidel or Phil Ivey. That was everybody else's pick. I haven't played with Eric Seidel or Phil Ivey the way I played with Baseball-y. He wasn't in my era. These guys wasn't in my era.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people be like, who's your favorite player? What's your favorite player? They'll say Ivey. They say Negreanu. They'll say Lindgren. These guys never played with these guys one day in their life. My favorite player is Eric Baldwin because I seen him grind. I seen the day before when he turned that switch on and then he went for play of the year. I was there that night. I was in Caesars. He was in a 5K event, and he pulled this move on the bubble. And I said, wow, this guy's going to be one of the best in the world. Ever since then, he inspired me to get to where I'm at. I followed part of his repertoire and what he's done to get to where he's at, and I've tried to base some of the stuff I do to try to get there, game selection, game management, trying to put yourself in position. So he's a player that affected my career. I was honored to have a chance to put him on my team, and he got the first pick.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of hard to go wrong with a guy like Eric Bolt.
I'm not slighting him at all. We think he's a terrific player. I think everybody was just a little bit surprised. First pick overall, not the kind of person that a lot of people would think, Baseball-y.
But the thing is, why not? Why not?
Yeah.
The reason why is time. How is he going to have Ivy numbers when he wasn't playing back then? Mm-hmm. How is he going to have $8 million in earnings when he wasn't playing with Negreanu? He was there for the last 4 years, and I think he's done great with what he's done.
Yeah.
In that era of time that he put together his resume, he's done better than all those boys you're talking about. He did better than Ivy. He did better than Negreanu. He did better than everybody else. So why shouldn't he be a number one pick?
Have you talked to him since you picked him first?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And what did he say?
He was like, you made me feel honored. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to put even a stronger foot forward to try to, make this team a winner.
Nice.
Excellent. All right. Well, I got a question. If you're sitting down at a table, would you rather have some of the old school there or a group of 22-year-olds that, just got done playing at the Internet? Do you have a favorite mix at the table that you like?
when it comes down to that, it's about who's the veteran and who's the playoff team. Who's the playoff team? Who's gonna get a 15-point lead and keep it? Who's gonna get a 15-point lead and blow it? It's teams that's ready for the season, and there's players that's ready for the playoffs. And it's just like poker. There's guys that's out there spewing in situations and trying things in situations. The guys that's going out there with a playoff game plan that's ready to do it. And if there's any holes in their game, you be the genius and try to find it. But it's gonna be hard to find, you know. So I would rather go against a seasoned player, as they would say, you know, like a guy that's ready for the season but not really ready for the playoffs, like a protege, like one of these online great players, one of these phenoms. They got like 15 proteges each, you know what I'm saying? So I'd rather go against one of their proteges than go meet up with any of the veterans in the live circle or the online circle, you know, because there's so many of their proteges that you could take advantage of because they know the game, the gist of it, but they don't know everything. They know the key situations.
Again, great point there. I have seen, we've talked about this before, somebody like Tom DeJuan. You watch the way he plays on a high-stakes poker or something. He makes some great moves. The guy's a great player. There's no doubt about it. In cash games especially, this guy is just, you know, he's there. But then you see other people that are, again, the 22, 23-year-old, they see that, they think they can do that, and they try to emulate him. But they don't know when to lay it down. They don't know when you can't force and forbet the way that Tom does. They're halfway there. Those are the guys I like to play against.
Exactly. A lot of people say Tom DeJuan raising 10-7 in the hijack. But what happened when he has his aces and he's on the turn and he lays those aces down when everybody else are calling?
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, those are the big differences. Anybody can raise any two cards. But what happens when you have a great hand that 88% of the world is calling with and you're laying it down? Those are the hands that makes Tom DeJuan who's Tom DeJuan. Because, yeah, he could play those wild cards. But when he's in a great spot and most people think that they have the other person and he realized something just switched up and I might be gone here, he's able to get away from those hands as well.
Yeah.
So at the same time, you got to be aggressive, but you got to know when to lay it down. And most of these guys pick up that one gear and get in the middle of the hand on the turn, and next thing you know, they drown him by the river.
Mm-hmm. I just had somebody just a couple of weeks ago ask me about, and I'm not going to say which pro it was, but said, what makes this guy so good? I said, well, to start with, he maximizes his gains and minimizes his losses. When he has it, he gets the most chips from his opponent, and when he thinks his opponent has it, he doesn't give them a ton of chips. This is how you're a successful poker player, and a hyper-successful poker player, in the long term. You make those right decisions every time. Minimize your losses, maximize your gains. That's the basic plan, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, you never do it every time, but you do a high percentage of the times. It's all the old sayings. You don't get married to a hand. You know, you can lay down a monster. You know, there's just so many of these things. They actually do ring true. People can slow play aces as long as you're willing to lay them down. You know, there's a big variety there. And these guys that try to do it, they see somebody else limp under the gun with aces, and they say, well, cool, you see the pot he just took? I'm going to try that next time. Next time they do it, and it comes out there with three diamonds and a possible straight, and they figure they still got the nuts. And, you know, situationally, you've got to be able to accept the consequences if you do an action. If your action is trying to slow play aces, you've got to be willing to lay them down. Now, that's just one example, but, you know.
Yep.
And so many of the guys have the first step, and they see that they can limp with the aces, but they don't have the second step to know to be able to get away from it.
Exactly.
You're taking a risk. Accept that and be able to get away from it.
Exactly. You got to be able to read the board textures and know
exactly. What's
going on.
We're at the final table here. Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris at the Rio in Las Vegas for the 2011 World Series of Poker. Our guest is Dwight Pilgrim. Every year when we're here, when we have a new guest on the show, I like to ask this question. Tell us about your first World Series of Poker experience. First time you came here, before you even played an event, and you walked in and saw the sea of poker players.
I think the first event I ever played the World Series was the 40K. I wanted to be one of the best, you know.
Yeah.
I was coming off the World Series circuit. I was real hot at the time, you know. So I went out there and I tried to be one of the best. I got it in with top two pair and a flush draw going to the river, and a guy hits an ace for like a two-outer. It shocked my world. But my first event in the World Series was rough because after you play a game like that, it's hard to resettle and get back into it and go on to the next level. But at the same time, I think those built in certain things in me, like the fear factor. You know, once you go in a game like that, once you go into any other game after that, the fear factor is all the way down because you're playing the biggest buy-in in the world.
Yeah.
And you're playing against the best players in the world. So when I went back to my other skill, I was able to do things that I never been able to do before, just because some of the things I learned over that one game. But other than that, I think in my first World Series was actually a losing one. But I learned so much. You know, it instilled so many things in me, makes me realize that maybe I have to take my game at another game. Made me examine myself. And that's what most poker players should do, examine themselves and figure out what makes them good. And after that, figure out what makes you great. And then try to keep doing it.
When I get into a final table or get something in front of a TV, a lot of times you can exploit the person that's their first time there, that they're nervous, they're not used to the mic and the cameras around there, and all of a sudden you look over to your side and there's a camera coming right up here, you know, 6 inches from your elbow type deal, and you have a stands around there. The first time or two that you got in front of the TV, did you feel those little quivers in your stomach? Were you a little bit nervous? Did you have to kind of take a deep breath and sit back for a minute or anything?
The first time I've been on TV was the Borgata. But before that, I've been kind of a hot player. You know, so I've been getting a lot of interviews. I've been in front of camera a lot for an up-and-coming player, you know. So by the time the Borgata came, I've been in front of the camera so much, it was normal for me. So these guys was the guys that was new. I was the veteran at that point, you know. So I felt like at that time, the cameras wasn't even there, you know. And I tried to put on, like, the best game I could. And the best show at the same time, because when it gets to that point of the game, people got to realize the show is bigger than the game. They don't pay a ESPN crew such and such or so much money. They don't have 300 people come in the stands for you to sit down and just be a regular game. It's a production at that point, you know. So at the end of the day, you try to put together your best game and, you know, something for the fans as well.
Now you can actually exploit some of the people because they don't want to be caught making a move with a 9-3 or something like that, and they tighten their game up until they get comfortable.
They don't want to be bluffed on TV either, so they probably make bad calls, don't they?
There are times, yes. You can exploit them.
Yeah.
Absolutely, you can.
See, I want to be caught showing the 9-3.
Dwight, you and I were talking before we started the show today about when you started out, you used to play a lot of online. Since Black Friday, that doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. But you told me you haven't been an online guy for the last couple of years because you've been touring so much. As I mentioned, WPT Tour and the World Series of Poker Tour and a lot of other events, the NAPT, when it existed, you were out there. How tough is it to be a touring poker pro? How much financial pressure is there on you, and how tough is it for you to have to pick up and go and play tournaments all over the country and, I guess, maybe even all over the world?
It's tough, you know. It's all about scheduling, you know. People don't realize styles make fights. It's about game selection. It's about putting yourself in the best position to win. You know, so the first step is looking over the schedule and picking the right games. You know, at the same time, you want to always be looking at bankroll management, because bankroll managers take most good players out of the game.
Yeah.
So I think as long as you're playing the games that match your style, the best games you could play, you know, watch your bankroll. And it's not a one-game-by-one-game thing. You know, if you want to go be the best in the world, you want to go to be player of the year, you want to go do this, you can't be going to play one game and say, oh, man, I just lost this one. Then you go play one game and like, oh, I'm the best in the world. With that being said, you got to keep yourself on an even keel. You can never get too low. You can never let to get too high. You know, you got to know what you're trying to do. Put together, you know, a script or a resume or something that's showing you what you're trying to do. My mom told me a long time ago, if you could put it on paper, you could get it done. You know, so put together 50 games, 25 games, and then say, all right, this 25 games cost me, let's say you're playing $500 tournaments, $300 tournaments. You know, that could cost you like, what, $10,000? Not even that much, $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
You go out there and say, you know what, my role right now is $15,000. I got 25 games. And then you go see if I can spring a profit. You know, 25 games is enough to see enough variance to, you know, go here and there. But if you're going to play 7 games, that's not enough to see any variance. You know, you could break 7 games just like you could break 25 games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you got to put it in front of you, and you got to have goals, and you got to know what you're attacking.
Well, there's so much to being a touring pro that most people don't realize. You're living out of a suitcase. You're becoming best friends with a stewardess. It's a different hotel room every week. You have a problem with eating patterns. You have a problem then in sleeping, you know. I mean, it's just you've really, really got to be focused and have a good mindset.
Plus, you've got all those expenses. It's not just the buy-ins. It's the hotel and the airfare, or if you drive to all these places, you know, gas and food and all that sort of stuff. And at the end of the day, you got to be able to not only manage your bankroll from the beginning, you got to watch your bankroll as you go along and keep track of what you're doing, and at the end say, did I actually come out ahead? Was I profitable with everything included, not just the $500 or $350 I bought into those tournaments for?
You got to keep an honest accounting is what you've got to do.
But all that stuff you could acquire for it too, because you don't know how much you'll spend. If you know the trips you're going to take, and you do everything in beforehand, you'll know how much everything is going to cost. So you'll know how much you got to do in the tournaments. You'll know how much you have to make up for that. But at the same time, you don't want to be doing that on a one-month basis as well. You know, it might take you 2 months to play 25 games. So at the same time, you have to set up 2 months of 25 games, 2 months of hotels and traveling, and see how much all that's going to cost, and then see if it's even worth trying to do this.
Yep.
You know, it might not be worth it.
Great point.
Yeah.
Great point.
And that's why when you go to a circuit event or you go to the WPT, you don't just play the main events. You go there, you'll play some of the side events. You may play some satellites or whatever. You maximize your value for the expenses you had for going there. So.
And that's why you want to play tournaments with a lot of players in it.
Yes.
You know, you want to come and play World Series events, the 1500s where you're going to get thousands, 2,000 players. You want to play the World Series circuit. I think that's one of the best pound-for-pound games they have out there right now, the main event for the World Series circuit. People are going to put up $1,600. Some of those prize pools are $250,000. When it's coming for dollar, I think that's the best for your money right now.
Here's some great advice from Dwight Pilgrim here on the Final Table Poker Radio Show. With Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas, I'm Paul Harris at Harris St. Louis. Next week, Kara Scott will join us, and I hope you will too. Tuesday at 3, we're live on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com, and you can always get our podcast via iTunes or on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. Thanks for listening.